The time is July 7th, 1937. Tensions are brewing in Europe, and America is waiting to see if a Second World War will break out. The Japanese have invaded Manchuria, and war is beginning between China and Japan. Across the Pacific Ocean, Alaskans are wondering what will happen next.
Japanese imperialism was on the rise. That was very clear, and consequently, American fear and anxiety about exactly what was going to be happening in the Pacific and how Alaska might be drawn into that conflict was very much on Alaskans' minds.
That's Alaska historian Ross Cohen. He says at that time, another conflict is brewing in the waters of Bristol Bay. He says it's hard to know exactly how many vessels entered Alaskan waters that week, but it may have been as many as 30.
Now, this is about four or five large processing vessels, what they called floating canneries. These were ships that had processing and canning facilities right there on board the vessel. And then there were probably another couple dozen smaller trawlers that used gill nets to harvest the salmon, which were then transferred onto these motherships.
In the 1920s, fisheries off of Japan were declining, so the Japanese moved on to Kamchatka, a Soviet territory they had access to after the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. Those were in decline as well.
And so the Japanese moving into the eastern Bering Sea, coming into Alaska waters, was really a function of they had already overfished their home fisheries, and now they came into Alaska thinking that this was a fishery that they might find productive and economical.
At that time, the Fisheries Bureau prohibited the use of motorized vehicles, fish traps, and purse seines in Alaska. This was to ensure a 50% escapement of the spawning salmon to guarantee sustainability of the resource. This means the Alaskan fishermen were working on wooden vessels with only 900-foot maximum length gill nets.
But now you have these 10,000-ton steel Japanese vessels that are diesel-powered. They're operating gill nets 2, possibly even 3 miles in length. I mean, it was such a technological mismatch in favor of the Japanese that you're exactly right. It proved intimidating, and it really fed Alaskans' feelings of resentment.
Cohn says there had been a long-standing tension between resident Alaskan fishermen and the salmon canneries based in Seattle and San Francisco.
But yet when the Japanese enter Bristol Bay and threaten to, you know, extinguish the salmon fishery, all of a sudden you've got common cause between Alaskans and people in the lower 48. And it really aligned their interests in a way that hadn't quite happened before.
The United States came to an agreement with Japan that the Japanese would refrain from fishing in Alaskan waters. This agreement was honored until Japan and the United States entered World War II following the incident at Pearl Harbor. However, it came up once again more than a decade later. In 1953, the U.S., Canada, and Japan passed the North Pacific Fisheries Treaty, in which the region's resources were jointly managed by the three countries. This treaty is the model for international fisheries regulations today. Cohen says the Bristol Bay salmon crisis was the first time questions of international fishing boundaries really came to light.
I mean, for many, many years, Alaska fisheries were essentially secure simply by virtue of the fact that no other nation had the technological capability to enter the fishery and then economically harvest those fish. When the Japanese proved that it could be done in 1937, it was in many ways the start of these questions that we're still dealing with today.
He says that's just one of the many legacies of the 1937 Bristol Bay salmon crisis. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.